I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go riding in the damp, foggy midnight, you snort my good pony and you give me your best. For you know and I know, good horse amongst the rich ones, how oft time
we're told we live in a free country, but how free are we? We're told we live in a democracy because we have elections. Does our government work for us? The economy is booming, or so we hear. Why then are so many people hanging on for dear life? What is meant by the economy anyway? Who defines what's referred to as the national interest, and how? If we're exporting democracy to the world, why then do we have so many enemies? 2 million Americans are now in prison. Why? You might have heard the statistic that it would be cheaper to send every prisoner to college rather than keep them behind bars. But college grads won't work for 20 cents an hour, and prisoners must. We're told that if we just work hard, America is the land of opportunity. Why then are one-third of the people in homeless shelters employed full-time? Are we the victims of the largest pyramid scheme in history? And one more question. Why don't you hear these sorts of questions more often? These are the questions with which Lynn Gary and the Unwelcome Guest Collective launched their debut program 10 years ago. Over 500 episodes later, the questions are, sadly, just as pertinent. As the new Unwelcome Guest Collective, it's our intention to keep asking these impolite questions. We may not get invited to many parties, but thanks to Lynn, we know we're not alone. Over 500 individuals and stations worldwide download each episode weekly. Multiply 1,000 hours of smart analysis by 500 intelligent listeners, and you get 500,000 points of light illuminating the darkness. Like it or not, the party of unwelcome guests has become a force to be reckoned with. Welcome to Unwelcome Guests. My name is Teresa Caraggio, and I host a radio show called Third Paradigm, which focuses on community sovereignty and regenerative economics at thirdparadigm.org. I'd like to thank Robin Upton, who has invited me to do this very special guest episode. This is show number 520, marking 10 years worth of solid content, lectures, commentary, video narration, and entire books read chapter by chapter. After putting together one mere episode, I'm in awe of the indefatigable effort required to post these shows week after week, and of Lynn's unerring ear for talks that would still be essential, both at the time they aired and 10 years later. Lynn's monumental accomplishment, however, might have ended up buried in the rubble of the internet if it were not for Robin Upton. Besides keeping Unwelcome Guests going, the website he's created to archive it at unwelcomeguest.net is nothing short of phenomenal. For each of the 500 episodes, he's generated a list of titles with descriptive subtitles, which makes finding what you're interested in much easier. Each title links to a page with a unique photo, a detailed summary, and links to the speakers and the source materials. There's an index that sorts the episodes by topics and another index of speakers. I can find out that while Raj Patel once worked for the World Bank, UN, and the WTO, he's also been tear gassed on four continents protesting them. I can see a photo of him, link to his website or Wikipedia page, and I can find all the episodes that feature him. Robin's own website at altruist.org focuses on the gift economy. There, he's compiled about 150 audio files, a couple dozen books, and many articles. I've spent many hours listening to these talks, but wished that there was a place where I could keep notes on them, about the content and the audio quality, and a forum to discuss the ideas in them. Answering my wishes, Robin has set up Unwelcome Guests as a wiki, with a discussion page on each show. In addition, he set up a virtual studio for collaboration. None of us are working in the kind of dream studio he pictured, but as long as it's a studio avatar, it may as well be equipped. It is well equipped, however, with content and functionality. There's a place to post show ideas and an index of material to choose from. To encourage listeners to participate, Robin has written files on how to find content, propose show ideas, improve episode plans, or even produce them. Some material from the vault includes recordings on Guantanamo from both sides of the wire, the ethnic cleansing of Palestine, and an interview with Lynn by Skidmark Bob. How does Robin get so much done? Well, one hint is that he's coined the word somnactivist for someone who wakes up with answers to problems they were apparently working on in their sleep. So whether you're a day or a night warrior, I encourage listeners to go to unwelcomeguest.net and join Robin's efforts. While there, you can also see the elusive lost episode number 6, which had disappeared from the archive. With some Indiana Jones sleuthing, Robin has made the arc complete. Now let's get on board with today's topic. In this Unwelcome Guest episode, we'll ask whether a higher education is the same as a deeper education. Higher education implies hierarchy, something that makes one person better than another. What Lynn Gary put together with Unwelcome Guest, however, has been a deep dive into the information, history, and tools for analysis needed to change the world. In episode number 4, Lynn states, "This series is actually a class in learning how to read between the lines." In the same episode, Michael Parenti gives the formula that an ounce of data is worth a pound of polemic. By college standards, then, the past 1,040 hours of hard data would have amounted to 78 credits, or several tons of fat-free global transformation. Don't you think that you deserve a little credit for all that you've learned? If you'd earned those 78 credits in a traditional college, you would have paid around $500 a credit once room and board had been figured in, or $39,000. If you were like the average college student, that would have meant taking out some loans. We'll start our show by getting a better understanding of college financing by listening to excerpts from 2 Third Paradigm episodes, The College Loan Scam and What's a Matter You. What's a Matter You was a Rocky and Bullwinkle routine, for those of you old enough to remember the joke. During the first hour, we'll continue to focus on college financing with an excerpt from Unwelcome Guest number 345, Dumb Down, Button Down, or Lockdown, Throw Away People in a Disposable Culture. In this show, Ben Mansky speaks about the public university in the age of corporatization. Say that 12 times fast. We'll also hear a reading from Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, written by Robert M. Persig. The second hour will focus on the feeder pool for college, the public high school. We'll highlight the work of John Taylor Gatto. Longtime listeners to Unwelcome Guest are well-versed on Gatto. Over the course of 44 episodes, Lynn read his seminal work, An Underground History of American Education. We'll introduce his thinking to new listeners through an interview done by Ken McDermott Rowe, host of History Counts. In his excellent show, Ken poses insightful questions to authors who illuminate the dark corners of our shadowy past. Then we'll hear an episode of New World Notes on Gatto, presented by another Connecticut radio Ken, Kenneth Doust. His episode ends with a short talk by Jonathan Kozol, a critic of education at the elementary school level. He'll be talking about preschools called the Baby Ivies, bringing us full circle back to a system in which the self-serving goal of education is more and more expensive education. But first, let's get a better understanding of the problems facing U.S. college students. This is Third Paradigm, Episode 49, entitled The Student Loan Mafia. It includes poems by Hafiz, Epictetus, and Bokanon, a character in Kurt Vonnegut's novel Cat's Cradle. Our title this week is The Student Loan Mafia. Our focus will be on a book by Alan Michael Colling called The Student Loan Scam. He's the founder of the political action group StudentLoanJustice.org. I first discovered them on Change.org. In the run-up to the presidential election, Change.org had a contest where users submitted ideas for policies that Obama should implement. The three ideas that received the top number of votes would be presented to Obama. I threw into the virtual hat some ideas about foreign policy and tax relocalization, but they were eclipsed by the overwhelming crush of people wanting absolution for student loans. At first, this annoyed me. After all, they signed up for them. We all had student loans. Stop sniveling and get to work. But then I started reading some of the stories. I found hardworking, responsible people who'd been ensnared in a web of debt they could never escape. I read about the draconian collection methods they'd been subjected to, and I thought, that can't be legal. But at StudentLoanJustice.org, I found it was not only legal, but subsidized by our taxes and enforced by our laws. The proof is in the data, so I ordered the student loan scam to get the details. It starts off with the author's story. To graduate with 3 degrees in aerospace engineering, he acquired about $38,000 in debt. By the time he graduated, this had become $50,000. He became a research scientist at Caltech, earning $35,000, with 20% of his salary repaying his loan. By the summer of 2001, to make ends meet, he decided to find a more lucrative job in the defense industry. He made the mistake of resigning from Caltech when the unforeseen event of 9/11 put a chill on hiring, and he was left without a job. He applied for an economic hardship forbearance, which Sallie Mae denied. They put his loan into default the next day, demanding the immediate payment of $60,000. Without work in his field, he took restaurant and cooking jobs, working 92 hours a week at less than minimum wage. By 2002, the collection agency was demanding $80,000 as immediate payment in full. The next 2 years, he worked for a nonprofit at $36,000, while his debt ballooned to $103,000. Collection calls added verbal assaults, intimidation, and humiliation. If only to prove their claims wrong, he worked obsessively, weekends and holidays, at no extra pay. In 2004, something snapped, and he started doing research. He found that Sallie Mae's stock rose 1,700% in the decade of 1995 to 2005. A major reason was the lobbying campaign that had stripped away the most basic consumer protections, including bankruptcy, repayment ceilings, truth in lending, and the right to refinance. They were given the power to garnish wages, Social Security, and disability benefits without even a court order. They could suspend professional licenses and terminate public employment. Because of subsidies, they made more from defaulted loans than loans in good standing. Executives had amassed fortunes that enabled Sallie Mae's CEO to bid $480 million to buy a baseball team. The Department of Education's Office of Federal Student Aid was run by ex-executives of student loan companies, with stock gifts and kickbacks greasing the skids at every level. Armed with this information, Alan started a website telling his own story and coaxed a few others to tell theirs. Like Rick, a laborer from California, who went to borrow $1,500 for automotive school. When they tried to get him to sign 2 promissory notes for the same loan, he got suspicious and canceled the loan. 5 years later, his tax return was garnished for a loan balance of $3,500. Petra, a Harvard grad who left law school with $40,000 in loans in '86. After a prolonged unemployment, she filed for bankruptcy, where a debt settlement was struck. But when the law changed in '98 and disallowed bankruptcy for student loans, creditors revived the dead loan and started hounding her for a whopping $152,000. Her husband ended up divorcing her because of the harassment and the threat to his own assets. These stories aren't flukes, but are part of a calculated strategy. One of the collection companies proudly displays a shark tank in their lobby to illustrate their corporate culture. But this shouldn't shock us. Getting rich is the American dream the educational system promotes. What should outrage us, however, is that Congress has been bought by the loan sharks. But before we raise our blood pressure, let's hear the poets, philosophers, and mystics remind us what college should be about. This is Hafiz, Epictetus, and Bokanon. The music is The Keeper by Bonobo. All the hemispheres. Leave the familiar for a while. Let your senses and bodies stretch out like a welcome season onto the meadows and shores and hills. Open up to the roof. Make a new watermark on your excitement and love. Like a blooming night flower, bestow your vital fragrance of happiness and giving upon our intimate assembly. Change rooms in your mind for a day. All the hemispheres in existence lie beside an equator in your heart. Greet yourself in your thousand other forms as you mount the hidden tide and travel back home. All the hemispheres in heaven are sitting around a fire chatting while stitching themselves together into the great circle inside of you. Hafiz, from The Subject Tonight is Love, Versions of Hafiz by Daniel Levinsky. Of being, caretake this moment. Immerse yourself in its particulars. Respond to this person, this challenge, this deed. Quit the evasions. Stop giving yourself needless trouble. It is time to really live, to fully inhabit the situation you happen to be in now. You are not some disinterested bystander. Exert yourself. Respect your partnership with Providence. Ask yourself often, how may I perform this particular deed such that it would be consistent with and acceptable to the divine will? Heed the answer and get to work. When your doors are shut and your room is dark, you are not alone. The will of nature is within you, as your natural genius is within. Listen to its importunings. Follow its directives. As concerns the art of living, the material is your own life. No great thing is created suddenly. There must be time. Give your best, and always be kind. From Epictetus, The Art of Living, a new interpretation by Sharon LaBelle. Life is a garden, not a road. We enter and exit through the same gate, wandering. Where we go matters less than what we notice. Bokanon from The Lost Book. That was Bonobo with the instrumental version of The Keeper from the CD of the same name. Let's examine how it got to this. In 1972, Nixon established the Student Loan Marketing Association, or Sallie Mae, as a government-sponsored agency. He increased loans and grant aid to students while defunding higher education. In the 90s, however, an ambitious CEO named Albert Lord privatized Sallie Mae but kept the subsidies. He gave kickbacks to universities if they made Sallie Mae their preferred lender. He gave perks to financial aid officials, like trips to exotic places, golf outings, parties, and even stock. Family members were given jobs. Federal direct loans, which were cheaper for the taxpayer, were strangled while Sallie Mae received enhanced subsidies. They started buying up all parts of the process,
collection agencies, and guarantors who are supposed to oversee the process. By 2006, they were four times the size of their closest competitor, Citibank. Their private student loans could charge interest rates approaching 30%. Using their clout in Congress, legislation allowed for massive penalties and fees for delinquent debt, which made it more profitable when students defaulted than when they paid. Student loans became the only type of debt to be non-dischargeable in bankruptcy, no matter what hardship was proven, which was expanded to include private loans at exorbitant interest. All statutes of limitations were eliminated, so old loans from the 70s and 80s became new collectible debt. They were exempt from state usury laws and the Truth in Lending Act. Guarantors could ignore the Fair Debt Collection and Practices Act when pursuing defaulted borrowers. It became impossible to tell where the university ended and the student loan companies began. Lenders gave hundreds of thousands in university donations and then ran call centers staffed with their own employees masquerading as the college's financial aid department. University nonprofits held hundreds of thousands of lender stock shares, which would gain or lose value depending on whose loan they promoted. Federal direct loans disappeared from these colleges' options. Financial aid directors were given lucrative fees for consulting with lenders. One section of the book, called Larry Loves Tequila, outlines other methods. But perhaps the deepest cut of all was legislation that required a lender to consolidate their loans with the original lender and never leave, even if other lenders offered better terms. For a short time, a loophole was found called the Super Two-Step, and borrowers rushed to refinance their debt. But the head of the House Education Committee, John Bonner, then received the largest amount of student loan PAC money, and his daughter got a job with a subsidiary of Sallie Mae. And so the loophole was closed. There are reasons they didn't want students to pay off their loans. Legislation provided for collection rates of up to 25% to be added to the debt as soon as it went into default. Congress provided the loan guarantors and collection companies with powers that would make a mobster envious, according to Harvard professor Elizabeth Warren. They included wage, Social Security, and disability garnishment, tax seizure, suspension of state-issued professional licenses, and termination of public employment. Full permanent disability was the only circumstance under which the loan could be absolved, but it then showed up as taxable income, fully burdened with fees and interest, so the tax payment was more than the original loan. So where are we now? There are more than 5 million defaulted student loans on record with the U.S. Department of Education, totaling $40 billion. Millions of more graduates have bought their way out of penalties and fees to be just barely out of default. The stories range from those resentful of not being able to refinance to those who decided that life wasn't worth living under this insurmountable weight. Increasing numbers are coming forward who've been driven out of the country, while an untold number have gone off-grid, working under the radar. The student loan scam does end on a hopeful note. The grassroots movement it started instigated the Student Borrower Bill of Rights. Alan Colling outlines solutions and where they are in process. He also gives practical advice that's worth the $23 as a graduation present for any high school senior. But the key underlying problem is reducing the price tag for college. In the following episodes, I'll be exploring a paradigm shift, moving from degree-driven education to a decentralized credentialing system based on the model of Wikipedia. That was from episode 49, The Student Loan Mafia, and this is from episode 61, What's the Matter, You? I'm not the only one looking for alternatives to the degree factories. The New York Times just ran an article called Placing the Blame as Students Are Mired in Debt. It tells the story of Courtney Muna, whose father died when she was 13 and whose mother runs a bed and breakfast. She worked hard to get good grades and was accepted to NYU, where she majored in religion and women's studies. First, she got federal loans and her mother co-signed a loan for $20,000. But when Sallie Mae rejected a third loan, NYU sent them to Citibank
from whom she borrowed another $40,000 over the next 2 years. Finally, NYU said they could get her another $2,000, at which point the mother claims they should have said, "You are in deep doo-doo, little girl." 5 years after graduation, she's $97,000 in debt with no prospect of repayment. With tuition, room, and board, NYU comes to $52,000 a year, or $208,000 for 4 years. Somehow, with grants and work study, Courtney must have managed another $111,000 to get that BA. As an investment, this would be like buying a house with over 50% down. But for Courtney, that remaining 50% has been disastrous. Since her graduation, the most she's made is $22 an hour, which barely pays the rent. Her potential to have a decent life is slim, with the interest mounting and no way out. The article, as the title states, looks for someone to blame. It blames her for majoring in something as non-market-driven as religion or women. It blames her mother for being proud of her daughter and co-signing on the American dream. But it gives Sallie Mae a pass on the blame, because after all, they got the mother to sign, who could sell her bread and breakfast to repay. Shrewd business move. The author wonders what Citibank could have been thinking, but concludes that they kept loaning because, if she had to drop out, she'd be less able to repay. Most of the blame, however, the author places on NYU for not counseling students who can't afford it, that they just don't belong there. But then he makes excuses for NYU and the loan counselors, because how would they keep their jobs and stay open if they discourage middle-class students? However, he says, they should require a financial solvency course where the students use their own families as case studies. So who really does belong at NYU? According to the author, children of the wealthy and a much smaller number of low-income students to whom it can afford to give enormous scholarships. The middle class, it implies, should stick with their kind in the state schools. Let's look this dripping elitism in the eye. Even if you're in with the in crowd and can afford $208,000 without the humiliation of a drawers around the knees show me what you've got finance course, is NYU worth it? If it's not a good investment at half the cost, then it's not worth the money that full boat parents are paying for it. If the major Courtney chose was the problem, then our universities are really upscale trade schools, foregoing learning in order to develop marketable skills. If a young person actually wants to learn, they'd be better off taking unpaid apprenticeships or volunteering while making a meager living on the side. Whatever they learn will be their responsibility, but they can keep it up for the rest of their life without the debt hanging over their head. The reporter, however, could use an education. How can he write an article in the money section of the New York Times without knowing that Citibank and Sallie Mae are better off when student loans default? His own paper has run two articles in the last few years entitled "The Student Loan Scam." Doesn't he read his own paper? He could have read Alan Michael Collins' book by that title, which they reviewed and we reviewed in our episode, "The Student Loan Mafia." Blaming the victims while apologizing for the banks, however, is probably better for his career. We're now going to look at a Washington Examiner article by Glenn Reynolds called "Higher Education's Bubble is About to Burst." It compares college to the housing market for the return on investment. Like California real estate, the cost of a new 4-year degree has gone up over 400% in one generation. Unlike California real estate, that doesn't mean you can sell the one you already bought for 4 times as much. In both, as the product becomes more expensive, cheap credit encourages higher debt. It becomes normalized, as what everyone does. Parents and students see it as their only ticket to prosperity, no matter what the cost, and so they sign on. But according to Reynolds, the bubble is ready to burst. Student loan demand is going soft. Jobs for new grads are looking wobbly. Websites are springing up with titles like "The Great College Hoax." The once shimmering horizon is starting to look more like an oil slick in which sea turtles are burning. As a law professor, Reynolds wonders if academic institutions will survive the implosion, or whether new ways of teaching and learning will come out of left field. He cites Anya Kamenetz and the Edupunks, and places his bets on the latter. After reading DIYU myself, I tend to agree. Let's see why. The first part of the book researches the history, sociology, and economics of how we got here, starting with statistics. 9 out of 10 high school seniors say they want to go to college. 34% expect to get a bachelor's, and 35% want to go to graduate school. Higher education is the closest thing we have, Kamenetz claims, to a world religion. In 1900, 500,000 people worldwide went to college. A century later, it was 100 million people. A mere decade later, it's risen to 150 million. But here in the U.S., where there's a will, there's no apparent way. 3 out of 10 students drop out of high school. Of those who start a four-year college, only 53% will graduate within 5 years, resulting in only 36% of all high school students ending up with a four-year degree. On Democracy Now!'s 4th of July special, Michael Moore talked about being in the other 64% with just a high school diploma. It doesn't seem to have hurt him. High school counselors often quote the $1 million premium that a college degree adds to your lifetime salary. But as the cost of an education has gone up, the wage premium for a college degree has stayed flat since the turn of the millennium. While degreed incomes have plateaued, however, non-college incomes have declined sharply. So the payoff's the same at the higher ante, but the fear of losing everything keeps us in the high-stakes game. Apropos of Michael Moore, Kamenetz reports on teenagers forced into college by the closing of GM. Before, high school students had the option of a union job and a good life, like their parents. But now they have to compete for increasingly scarce white-collar jobs. Stanford sociologist Mitchell Stevens writes, "College was about improving your circumstances. It wasn't a baseline for survival." What does it mean if college is the only avenue to a decent living in this century? That's the conversation we're not having nationally. In 1987, Mark Blogg took a jaundiced look at college in The Economics of Education and the Education of an Economist. He found it impossible to single out the effects of an education. Better educated people, he writes, have better educated parents, come from smaller homes, obtain financial help more easily, live in cities, are better motivated, achieve higher scores in intelligence and aptitude tests, attain better academic grade records, gain more from self-education, and generally live longer and are healthier. They earn more simply because they've had all the advantages in life, of which more education is only one, and not even the most important one. What if parents who had the money to send their kids to college chose to have them earn it instead by teaching themselves? They could learn in peer group settings from the information abundantly available in books, on the web, in videos, and audio files. Even better, what if they first learned what their parents had to teach, or their neighbors, or community groups in their town? Everywhere you turn, there are people with passions on any given subject. Give the scarecrow or the tin woodsman a diploma tied with a ribbon, and you'll find he's as clever as any professor. To do a true comparison of the investment value of a degree, you'd first have to find motivated students who would put the same amount of time and effort into learning for 4 to 5 years without an institution hanging over their heads. And then you need to equalize the money. To compare apples to apples, academically speaking, we have to see how the self-educated student would do if, at the end, they could use the money they didn't spend on college for a down payment on a house. Maybe their income wouldn't be the measure we use for success, but the freedom to pursue a good life that neither serves other people's interest nor requires that other people serve theirs. While Wall Street and the government might not hire them, they'd have the self-discipline to work for themselves. and even better for our democracy, they'd be able to think for themselves.
Those were excerpts from two episodes of Third Paradigm, The Student Loan Scam and What's the Matter You. We'll now go to Unwelcome Guest number 345 with Ben Mansky with more on college financing.
This is a recording of Ben Mansky on Higher Education and the Democracy Movement, the Public University in an Age of Corporatization. He spoke at the Democracy and Education Conference at the Storrs campus of the University of Connecticut on April 2, 2006.
I want to start off by taking a look back to ancient history for a lot of us, 1979. All right. And I want to do that to understand just how much higher education has changed in one generation in the United States, and specifically public universities and public education. In 1979, and all these figures are real dollars, right? These are today's dollars. Think of it as today's money. 1979, the average cost of tuition at a public institution for a year, $1,600. $1,600. 58% of those who entered community college or public university graduated within 4 years. 58%. 52% of federal financial aid came in the form of grants, and it was only at that time, 45% that were college loans that had to be repaid back. Sending somebody in your family to a public university or community college cost 6 to 13% of the average working class person's family income. 6 to 13%. More than 70% of the funding for public institutions came from public sources, not from tuition, not from corporations, but from the states, from municipalities, from the federal government, 70%. There was extensive federal investment and state investment too in renewable energy and sustainable agriculture, in investing in the economy of the future, an ecological economy. You also saw that students and the public were gaining more control over the universities, and that was really a product of the movements of the 1960s. But you saw the creation of shared governance structures, both in policy and in statute in some states, that gave students rights to participate in the governance of their institutions. And then finally, of course, campuses were seen as hotbeds of activism, or as I like to say, centers of civic participation, right? Now, that sounds pretty good, right? You all agree that was, that sounds like a vision for higher education. I'm seeing some heads nod. I want to hear some agreement. If you disagree, you can shout at me. All right, yeah. Well, for some people, higher education in 1979 was a disaster. It was terrible, and they had to change it. It was inefficient. It was ineffective. It was not serving the aims that they had for higher education and for the future economy in the United States. And so they began to use their political muscle and their money and their privileges to transform higher education in the United States. And this is what we started to see. First of all, in the 1980s, you started to see universities become more permeable, more accessible to corporate influence. And one of the major pieces of legislation, if you haven't heard of it, was signed by President Carter in 1980. Does anybody know what legislation I'm talking about?
Bayh-Dole
Act. All right, this is good. So there's your student trustee here. The Bayh-Dole Act of 1980, one of Carter's last acts as president, passed through, I believe, a Democratic Congress too, right? What it did was it allowed public universities to use public funds to conduct research, which could become the proprietary interest of private corporations. In other words, corporations could sign contracts with universities and use public money, student tuition money as well, to produce research which was not publicly owned, but owned by Monsanto, owned by Exxon, right? This opened the doors to the corporatization of research at public institutions. And it was really pivotal, because after that, a lot of things started to change in terms of funding priorities at universities. So you saw the Bayh-Dole Act. You started to see lobbying that was effective to replace grants with loans that had to be repaid. You saw the push towards NAFTA and the creation of the World Trade Organization start to get going, right? I mean, Bush Sr., Papa Bush, wanted it. He didn't get it, but he made that agenda move. You saw major cuts in funding for public education. And then by the early 1990s, you saw corporatization really in overdrive. It just took off. And it took off in all sectors of society, but in higher education and in K through 12 public education in particular. And there's a couple things that happened. You saw tuition start to skyrocket, just rise in a big way. Instead of 2 to 3% increases in tuition, now you started to see 8%, 10%, 11%, right? And that's just increased more in the last several years. You saw the development of what they called public-private partnerships. And these were not really partnerships of any real kind. They were actually exploitive relationships in which a private corporation would take advantage of public resources, as was the case and is the case with university research. You saw the development of promotional contracts with private corporations, Coca-Cola, Reebok, Nike, coming in. That's actually where I got some of my start in terms of campus organizing, was when Reebok came in and basically bought the rights to the Bucky Badger in the University of Wisconsin athletic department. And I'm proud to say that the University of Wisconsin no longer has an exclusive marketing agreement with any apparel corporation. So it took a long time. But that's, that was like a side effect of our organizing there. You saw the promotion of vouchers in K through 12 education, sort of the privatization of K through 12 of public education, and that certainly had an impact on students entering into public institutions. You saw the very well-funded attack on multiculturalism and political correctness, right? It's interesting who talks about political correctness, not the left, but the right. Very well-funded attack, and what's not so well-known is where that money has come from, which I'm going to be talking about a little bit more in terms of funding that attack on multiculturalism, on political correctness, and also, most importantly, on affirmative action. You saw the creation of the World Trade Organization and the General Agreement on Trade and Services as a side agreement. How many people have heard of the GATS? Okay, good. So if you asked that question 10 years ago, no hands would have gone up, but that was when they were starting to talk about it. Essentially creating a global structure for imposing corporatization from above on public education, on health, on every aspect of public life. And so you saw that in the 1990s. You saw an attack on student fee autonomy. That was a very well-funded campaigning that ended in the Southworth decision before the United States Supreme Court. 2004 was basically the end of that fight. How many people have heard of Southworth? Okay, so this is an important thing to inform yourselves about because it's very interesting. Those who oppose student power are much more familiar oftentimes with where our power comes from than we ourselves are, right? In the 1960s and the 1970s, student activists carved out some autonomy, some control over student fees, some role in shared governance. And in some places, it really had a profound effect on organizing. University of Wisconsin at Madison, the student association has a $20 million a year budget. $20 million. That's big time. It's a big school. So the right wing gets some money, and the Alliance Defense Fund out of Arizona finds some plaintiffs, and they sue the University of Wisconsin at Madison to say, you can't fund the Campus Women's Center, you can't fund the UW Greens, you can't fund the Black Student Union, because forcing students to pay student fees that can be used for the expressive activity of groups that they disagree with is a violation of their constitutional First Amendment rights. Okay, so that was their lawsuit. It was a very smart, well-funded, strategic attack on student power. And they almost succeeded. They almost succeeded. You saw that happen. You also started to see the remilitarization of the campus. I don't know, it would be interesting to do an audit. I don't know how many campuses you got sort of the campus police forces walking around with automatic rifles, but you sort of got to ask yourself, why are they rearming with AR-15s, you know, the same weapons that the United States illegally supplied the Contras with, right? So you started to see that in the 1990s too. And we can see the results of corporatization today. So I gave you some statistics and an image of what higher education looked like in 1979. Let's look at it in 2000, 21 years later. Tuition more than doubled. Now, and by now I'm talking 2000 here, it was almost $4,000 a year for tuition at most public institutions. Now that doesn't sound like a lot, but remember we're including community colleges and technical colleges here too. And of course it's increased by about another $1,000 in the 6 years since 2000, right? We went from a 58% graduation rate to a 50%. graduation rate. And you think about what kinds of communities and what kinds of students were most directly impacted. We talk a lot about recruitment and retention of students of color, but 70% of African-American students who don't complete graduation say that the cost of education was the number one reason why they couldn't finish, the cost of education. So, you know, making the campus a nice place to be is all good, you know, but driving down tuition, that's key. You know, anybody who gets to a public institution, they're fighting to be there. We got to make it more accessible. We went from 52% of college aid as grants to only 39%. So there's a reversal between grants and loans. And your generation of graduates is the most indebted generation of young people in American history. The average student who graduates from a public institution in the United States after 4 years for undergrad leaves with almost $20,000 in debt.
That was Ben Mansky from Unwelcome Guest 345, speaking about the need for more student control, more federal grants, less corporate financing, and lower tuition. In Mansky's talk, however, I didn't hear his idea for where the money was going to come from. According to him, universities shouldn't be a privilege for the rich. They should be an entitlement for anyone who works hard to get there. But the problem with education isn't just the price tag. An article from the Toronto Globe and Mail quotes Jason Price, an assistant professor at the University of Victoria, as saying, "Unschooling is an acknowledgement that schools and education are in many ways contradictory, that there is an implicit tension between them. Education is about the production of more democracy, production of peace, production of happiness, whereas schooling is often the production of global economic competitiveness." As an assistant professor, I'd say he's living both his contradictions and his convictions. But is learning the product of teaching? Should the teacher be responsible for what the student learns? Can they be? The student who gets accepted to college has created their own ability to learn, or they wouldn't be there. Yet they pay dearly to have someone else tell them what they must learn. At 18 years old, a person is legally an adult. Yet we consider them successful only if they place themselves under someone else's authority for another 4 to 8 years, whether that person is a sergeant or a professor. If they're successful, this will then lead to being under someone else's authority for the rest of their life. For a radically different view, let's listen to an excerpt from Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance by Robert M. Persig. The narrator tells the story of Phaedrus, who is his younger self, before the mental breakdown and electroshock therapy. He always speaks of Phaedrus in the third person.
I have since read Aristotle again, looking for the massive evil that appears in the fragments from Phaedrus, but have not found it there. What I find in Aristotle is mainly a quite dull collection of generalizations, many of which seem impossible to justify in the light of modern knowledge, whose organization appears extremely poor, and which seems primitive in the way old Greek pottery in the museums seems primitive. I'm sure if I knew a lot more about it, I would see a lot more, and not find it primitive at all. But without knowing all that, I can't see that it lives up either to the raves of the Great Books group or the rages of Phaedrus. I certainly don't see Aristotle's works as a major source of either positive or negative values. But the raves of the Great Books group are well known and published. Phaedrus's rages aren't, and it becomes part of my obligation to dwell on these. "Rhetoric is an art," Aristotle began, "because it can be reduced to a rational system of order." That just left Phaedrus aghast. Stopped. He'd been prepared to decode messages of great subtlety, systems of great complexity in order to understand the deeper inner meaning of Aristotle, claimed by many to be the greatest philosopher of all time. And then to get hit, right off, straight in the face, with an ample statement like that. It really shook him. He read on. "Rhetoric can be subdivided into particular proofs and topics on the one hand, and common proofs on the other. The particular proofs can be subdivided into methods of proof and kinds of proof. The methods of proofs are the artificial proofs and the inartificial proofs. Of the artificial proofs, There are ethical proofs, emotional proofs, and logical proofs. Of the ethical proofs, there are practical wisdom, virtue, and goodwill. The particular methods employing artificial proofs of the ethical kind involving goodwill require a knowledge of the emotions, and for those who have forgotten what these are, Aristotle provides a list. They are anger, slight, subdivisible into contempt, spite, and insolence, mildness, love or friendship, fear, confidence, shame, shamelessness, favor, benevolence, pity, virtuous indignation, envy, emulation, and contempt. Remember the description of the motorcycle given way back in South Dakota? The one which carefully enumerated all the motorcycle parts and functions? Recognize the similarity? Here, Phaedrus was convinced, was the originator of that style of discourse. For page after page, Aristotle went on like this. Like some third-rate technical instructor, naming everything, showing the relationships among the things named, cleverly inventing an occasional new relationship among the things named, and then waiting for the bell so we can get on to repeat the lecture for the next class. Between the lines, Phaedrus read no doubts, no sense of awe, only the eternal smugness of the professional academician. Did Aristotle really think his students would be better rhetoricians for having learned all these endless names and relationships? And if not, did he really think he was teaching rhetoric? Phaedrus thought that he really did. There was nothing in his style to indicate that Aristotle was ever one to doubt Aristotle. Phaedrus saw Aristotle as tremendously satisfied with this neat little stunt of naming and classifying everything. His world began and ended with this stunt. The reason why, if he were not more than 2,000 years dead, he would have gladly rubbed him out, is that he saw him as a prototype for the many millions of self-satisfied and truly ignorant teachers throughout history who have smugly and callously killed the creative spirit of their students with this dumb ritual of analysis, this blind, rote, eternal naming of things. Walk into any of 100,000 classrooms today and hear the teachers divide and subdivide and interrelate and establish principles and study methods. And what you will hear is the ghost of Aristotle speaking down through the centuries, the desiccating, lifeless voice of dualistic reason. The sessions on Aristotle were round an enormous wooden round table in a dreary room across the street from a hospital, where the late afternoon sun from over the hospital roof hardly penetrated the window dirt and polluted city air beyond. Wan and pale and depressing. During the middle of the hour, he noticed that this enormous table had a huge crack that ran right across it near the middle. It looked as though it had been there for years, but that no one had thought to repair it. Too busy, no doubt, with more important things. At the end of the hour, he finally asked, "May questions about Aristotle's rhetoric be asked?" "If you have read the material," he was told. He noticed in the eye of the professor of philosophy the same set he had seen the first day of registration. He took warning from it that he had better read the material very thoroughly, and did so. The rain comes down more heavily now, and we stop to snap on the face mask to the helmet. Then we go again at moderate speed. I watch for chuck holes, sand, and grease slicks. The next week, Phaedrus had read the material, and was prepared to take apart the statement that rhetoric is an art because it can be reduced to a rational system of order. By this criterion, General Motors produced pure art, whereas Picasso did not. If there were deeper meanings to Aristotle than met the eye, this would be as good a place as any to make them visible. But the question never got raised. Phaedrus put up his hand to do so, caught a microsecond flash of malice from the teacher's eye, but then another student said, almost as an interruption, "I think there are some very dubious statements here." That was all he got out. "Sir, we are not here to learn what you think," hissed the professor of philosophy, like acid. "We are here to learn what Aristotle thinks." Straight in the face. "When we wish to learn what you think, we will assign a course in the subject." Silence. The student is stunned. So is everyone else. But the professor of philosophy is not done. He points his finger at the student and demands, "According to Aristotle, What are the three kinds of particular rhetoric according to subject matter discussed? More silence. The student doesn't know. Then you haven't read it, have you? And now, with a gleam that indicates he has intended this all along, the professor of philosophy swings his finger around and points it at Phaedrus. You, sir, what are the three kinds of particular rhetoric according to subject matter discussed? But Phaedrus is prepared. Forensic, deliberative, and epideictic, he answers calmly. What are the epideictic techniques? The technique of identifying likenesses, the technique of praise, that of encomium, and that of amplification. Yes, says the professor of philosophy slowly. Then all is silent. The other students look shocked. They wonder what has happened. Only Phaedrus knows, and perhaps the professor of philosophy. An innocent student has caught blows intended for him. Now everyone's face becomes carefully composed in defense against more of this sort of questioning. The professor of philosophy has made a mistake. He's wasted his disciplinary authority on an innocent student, while Phaedrus, the guilty one, the hostile one, is still at large, and getting larger and larger. Since he has asked no questions, there is now no way to cut him down. And now that he sees how the questions will be answered, he's certainly not about to ask them. The innocent student stares down at the table, face red, hands shrouding his eyes. His shame becomes Phaedrus's anger. In all his classes, he never once talked to a student like that. So that's how they teach classics at the University of Chicago. Phaedrus knows the professor of philosophy now, but the professor of philosophy doesn't know Phaedrus. In the next sessions, the shamed student is no longer present. No surprise. The class is completely frozen, as is inevitable when an incident like that has taken place. Each session, just one person does all the talking, the professor of philosophy. And he talks and talks and talks to faces that have turned into masks of neutrality. The professor of philosophy seems quite aware of what has happened. His previous little eye flick of malice toward Phaedrus has turned into a little eye flick of fear. He seems to understand that within the present classroom situation, when the time comes, he can get exactly the same treatment he gave, and there will be no sympathy from any of the faces before him. He's thrown away his right to courtesy. There's no way to prevent retaliation now, except to keep covered. But to keep covered, he must work hard and say things exactly right. Phaedrus understands this, too. By remaining silent, he can now learn under what are very advantageous circumstances. Phaedrus studied hard during this period and learned extremely fast and kept his mouth shut. But it would be wrong to give the least impression that he was any sort of good student. A good student seeks knowledge fairly and impartially. Phaedrus did not. He had an axe to grind, and all he sought were those things that helped him grind it, and the means of knocking down anything which prevented him from grinding it. He had no time for or interest in other people's great books. He was there solely to write a great book of his own. His attitude toward Aristotle was grossly unfair for the same reason Aristotle was unfair to his predecessors. They fouled up what he wanted to say.
That was Michael Kramer reading from Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance by Robert M. Persick. This is Teresa Caraggio, and you're listening to Unwelcome Guest. Stay tuned for the second hour when we'll hear from John Taylor Gatto and Jonathan Kozol.